Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, Emery Roan, my co-host, joins me along with Rebecca Krutoff, who is the executive director of the Information Society Project at Yale and also an expert in lethal autonomous weapons systems, a.k.a. killer robots. So we're going to talk about them and AI. Are we ready for killer robots? Are they ready for us? Are they aiming at us? We will take on all of that, as well as look at this week's decision from the D.C. Circuit on the FCC's net neutrality rules and the FBI's vast database of biometric information, all that and more on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Emery Roan. Episode 350, recorded June 17th, 2016. Let loose the droids of war. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Braintree. Looking to set up payments for your business? Braintree gives your app or website a payment solution that accepts just about every payment method with one simple integration. Plus, Braintree will give you the first $50,000 in transactions fee-free. To learn more, visit braintreepayments.com/twill. Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. Welcome to This Week in Law. We have an amazing show for you today. I'm so glad that you've joined us today because the safety of the free and unfree world are at stake in the topics that we're going to be discussing today. Our guest today is Rebecca Krutoff. She is the incoming executive director of the Yale Information Society Project. She also just earned her PhD in law from the Yale Graduate School of Arts and Sciences, and she is a guru in all things related to autonomous weapons systems. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. Thanks so much for joining us. Also here with me this week is co-host Emery Roan. Hello, Emery.
Hey, Denise. Hey, Rebecca. Hey, listeners. This is honestly, I think, the best lineup I've ever had on this show. I'm so excited to be talking about what we have today. This is great.
I know. I'm excited, too. For folks who may just be encountering Emery for the first time, Emery is a 3L at California Western School of Law. He's focusing on cybersecurity, privacy, digital civil liberties. He's also had just this wonderful, when you've got it four times, quadfecta of internships. He's interning with us here at This Week in Law, which I certainly would have liked to do as a 3L. He's been an intern with New Media Rights and is still, right, currently an intern with the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse.
Yep.
And in the fall is going to have an internship with EFF. So you're on a roll.
It's the goal. Yeah.
That's right. Information Society Project at Yale fellow possibly could be, you know, meet the incoming executive director, Emery.
Well.
It's a good pair.
That would be nice.
All right. So we're going to jump right into a bunch of stuff that is in Rebecca's wheelhouse for the majority of the show today. Let's talk some robots. So not too long ago, in fact, right after We Robot, the conference, we had Michael Frumkin on the show. We're very interested in these topics in general. Rebecca spoke at We Robot, has done so more than once, I think. Right, Rebecca?
Just one. But we're hosting it next year at the ISP.
Yeah, that's awesome. So one of the most interesting topics to wrap your head around as we continue to develop artificial intelligence and autonomous systems in general are systems that, without any human intervention, are programmed to go in and kill stuff. So, Rebecca, can you kind of give us the lay of the land, where things stand with those kinds of technologies right now and how the world is grappling with regulating them?
Sure. First of all, I want to thank you for not starting off with a picture of the Terminator, because that is what everybody immediately goes to when I say I work on killer robots. So things to wrap your heads about around autonomous weapon systems in terms of what they are. First of all, they're not drones. Most people think that when I talk about autonomous weapon systems, I'm just talking about drones. But drones are actually semi-autonomous weapon systems insofar as there's a human being who's making decisions about selecting and engaging targets. They're just doing it remotely, you know, with some geographic and sometimes a slight temporal distance. Meanwhile, they're also not landmines. Landmines are geographically separated from the human deployer, and they act independently, but they act in a very automatic way. Autonomous weapon systems, in contrast to both of these sort of common or at least conventional weapons, existing weapons, have the capability of independently selecting and engaging targets. And in terms of the debate right now, there's some debate as to whether or not autonomous weapon systems already exist. There's a lot of people who are arguing that they're weapons of the future, but that they're coming soon. They're going to be here in 10 to 20 years, possibly even 5 years. There's also people like me who argue that we already have autonomous weapon systems that are being deployed. They're not always being used in their fully autonomous modes, but they nonetheless have that fundamental capability of independently selecting and engaging targets. And so one example, just to make things concrete, the SGRA-1 is a stationary armed robot that's used to patrol, well, it's stationary, but it's used to monitor the Korean Demilitarized Zone. And it uses, I believe it's actually, you know, Kinect technology, PlayStation technology, to identify human forms and train a gun on them, order them to halt and surrender. And South Korea maintains that these robotic systems are being used in conjunction with human operators. So they're being used in a semi-autonomous mode. But the manufacturer has also said that they have an autonomous mode where they wouldn't need a human operator, in which they could independently identify a human being and engage it.
Wow.
So is the analogy kind of like the autopilots that fly all the commercial planes in our skies today, that technically they can do everything that a pilot would need to do, but the pilot is there for oversight and emergency purposes? Are they operating sort of along those lines?
Yeah, I would call the autonomous weapon systems that are in use today human-supervised autonomous weapon systems. And this follows the U.S. Department of Defense terminology in one of their direct policy directives on autonomous weapon systems, where they basically say that human-supervised autonomous weapon systems are in use today.
And wow. Apologies to all my pilot friends that I just called you unnecessary. That's not what I meant at all. Apologies to Rebecca, too, that right before I began the show, we did not flash up a graphic of the Terminator, but I did tweet, come with us if you want to live. So I am definitely guilty.
I wrote and then deleted two different tweets that were both like, I for one, look forward to talking about our robot overlords tomorrow. But
there we go. I like that one, too. All right, Rebecca. So we have some of these systems in place in the world today in a supervised kind of capacity. Who was it you just mentioned who said that such things must be supervised?
So the Department of Defense has a U.S. Department of Defense has a policy directive saying that there are that it's okay to have human supervised autonomous weapon systems. There's also a large debate about what that actually is going to entail, what's going to constitute sufficient supervision. What the sort of jargon of the moment is, what is meaningful human control? And there's a lot of variations on what control means and on what meaningful means. Some states would say that there needs to be a human in the loop, actively making the decision every time there's a decision to select and engage a target to use lethal force against another human being. Other states would argue that having a human on the loop, just sort of monitoring the system with veto power, that would constitute sufficient human control, meaningful human control. And still other states are sort of arguing that you know, as if a human wrote the program and a human incorporated sufficient rules into the program that's directing the autonomous weapon system, that is actually sufficient, meaningful human control.
Okay, so we don't have agreement on that front. And you mentioned it's the Department of Defense the United States Department of Defense who has said, well, we have to have some sort of human oversight. Then we can get into the weeds over what that means. How does the U.S. Defense Department's policy translate into what other countries will do?
Right, yeah.
Well, the great thing about the U.S. policy is that it's public. As far as I know, and I could say this with more assurance about 6 months ago, it is the only public policy on a state's use of autonomous weapon systems. I think Britain is sort of, the UK is the next up in terms of they've published some policy related to autonomous weapon systems, and they've come out explicitly against a ban on all autonomous weapon systems. As far as I know, they're the only state that's done that so far. But really, it's the only public state policy, military policy on autonomous weapon systems. And so I think it's just going to be huge. It's definitely been hugely influential in the academic discourse in terms of informing how states are thinking about these systems. And I think it's likely to be influential for other states that maybe weren't thinking about what their policies were even going to be yet.
So the Korea example that you gave earlier, they haven't said anything about their use of these maybe autonomous robots, besides that they may or may not have a human attached to them at some point?
They've said that they are human supervised, that they don't operate in an autonomous mode, and that's pretty much the extent of it.
Huh.
I think there is, this is completely separate and tangential, I think there might be a South Korean call for a code of robot ethics, so that may or may not be related. I don't think that's a military code.
Right.
Huh. This is so fascinating. I have so many questions, but I know that we're talking about this in sort of an international state warfare context, and I'm remembering at the same time the textbook case from Torts 1 about trap guns. I don't even know how to frame this question. This is so crazy.
Well, remind... Let's remind our non-lawyer listeners what that textbook case was. And this is the thing that everybody learns in torts in law school, and torts is one of Rebecca's specialties as well. And the torts is liability, non-criminal liability for harming people in a physical way. So when they're, and also it doesn't necessarily have to be harm to people, but again, we won't get too far down the road there. What Emery is referring to is the situation where in an effort to defend one's property, someone has set up an automated gun. Typically, if I'm remembering the facts of the trap gun case, right, I think it was in the garage.
Yeah.
And if the door is opened, the gun goes off. It's set up just to fire, the landmine example that Rebecca gave earlier, except this time it's a gun pointed out the door. And this is a case that every law student studies, and it's a classic example of how, no, you can't do that. Yes, you're going to be responsible if you injure somebody with this sort of defense mechanism at your house. So have I filled enough to give you time to frame your question, Emery?
Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, for all of our non-legal experts out there, and I mean, actually anyone can probably understand that the importance there is that in the trap gun case, there's no one that could veto that power to, kill someone. That if it happened, if, the condition is met, then the gun fires and kills someone, regardless of whether or not a human has any input in that. I know that, Rebecca, you've worked a lot, or you've written about the idea of war torts. I was sort of under the impression, I guess I don't know anything about international war law, but I was sort of under the impression that every nation basically respected that idea, that you want to have a person behind the trigger. But I guess clearly I was incorrect. At least Britain has not allowed or said that they would outright ban autonomous weapons. I guess I want to just put that over to you. Do you want to give our listeners a little bit of background about war torts and sort of how this works into that discussion?
Sure. Trying to distill that. So
yeah, sorry about weapons, that.
No, it's a great question. Two things to go down on. First is the law of armed conflict obviously allows for the killing of people. It just allows for the killing of some people and not others. So there are lawful targets. There are combatants are lawful targets, civilians who are directly participating in hostilities, right? People who take up guns and fight the enemy forces are lawful targets. And there are lawful objects that can be targeted, just military objectives. There's also unlawful targets. So that would be civilians, wounded or surrendering soldiers are unlawful targets, and civilian objects. And civilian objects include a host of different things, from hospitals to museums to livestock, et cetera. And the whole aim, I think, of the law of armed conflict, also known as international humanitarian law, is to minimize the harm and minimize to those unlawful targets and make sure that militaries only use force against lawful targets. And there are a host of subsidiary rules that autonomous weapon systems challenge in different ways. One of the issues raised by autonomous weapon system is who do you hold accountable when an autonomous weapon system commits a serious violation of international humanitarian law? These serious violations usually are committed by human beings, and they're called war crimes when they're committed by a human being, because a person has to act with intention or with recklessness to commit a war crime. But you can imagine a situation where an autonomous weapon system, because of its capability for independent action, takes some action that would constitute a serious violation of international humanitarian law, but nobody along the line, from the programmer to the developer to the manufacturer to the commander to the deployer, no person acted willfully, which is to say with the intention of causing that violation, or recklessly, you know, acting notwithstanding knowledge of the likelihood of the consequences. And in that very hard case, there's no one who can be held accountable under existing international humanitarian law, international criminal law, rather. There's no individual criminal liability when there's no willful action. And so I make the argument in my war torts piece that we need to, that this is an issue that's highlighted by autonomous weapon systems, this possibility of serious violations where nobody acts willfully. And we need a new legal regime to address when this happens. And autonomous weapon systems highlight, you know, that it happens, but it also happens in other situations. I think there's a case to be made that things like the bombing of the Doctors Without Borders hospital might constitute a war tort, if not a war crime, insofar as it was found that nobody acted, you know, the U.S. found in their investigation that nobody acted with intention and nobody acted recklessly. They attribute it to some technological errors. And I think that's a case, there's a case to be made that that's a war tort, and that the need for war tort, there's a need for war torts to minimize these actions that are otherwise there's no accountability for them, and also to provide compensation to the victims of those actions, which is part of the point of tort law, both minimizing on the front end and providing compensation on the back end. Going back to your original tort case example, and this is where I say the law of war allows for killings. There are such things as landmines, right? There are such things as tripwire sentry guns, and that,
right,
depending on how those are used, depending on how those are deployed, depending on whether they're anti-personnel or anti-tank, they can be lawful under the law of war. So it's not, you know, domestic law, which presumes that killing another person is likely unlawful. It's quite the opposite in the law of war.
Do you see any traction being picked up about the idea of war torts? Because I agree, it sounds like...
So it's very new. The piece that I wrote actually is in the final stages of publication right now. So I'm actually just initially right now trying to get the word out. I don't have the formal finalized published piece even yet. And that piece really focuses on autonomous weapon systems, how they raise this problem, how war torts might be, how there might be a good autonomous weapon systems might serve as a good pilot case for establishing a war torts regime, that it's sort of so clear that you have these accountability issues there. I'm hoping in a future piece to construct a stronger, broader argument for war torts more generally.
So is the defendant in a war tort kind of action where it was a technological issue that brought about whatever disastrous result is at stake, is the defendant always going to be the manufacturer of the system? And does that pose problems? Because those manufacturers may be governments who are immune to liability, or maybe on the opposite end, some third party non-corporate actor that is, black market throwing weapons together that are being used in war.
So that highlights the problem with trying to have individual tort liability for war crimes is that there's going to be a bunch of conflicting domestic tort law regimes, just as in the United States, we have a bunch of conflicting state tort law regimes. I'm arguing that at the international level, the states deploying the autonomous weapon systems are the entities that should be held accountable for war torts. Mm-hmm. And there's some precedent for this in prior cases before the International Court of Justice. But I think it should be recognized as its own issue. And then those states can then kind of turn around and determine through their domestic law processes what entities are the appropriate ones to hold liable, whether or not it should, the deployer or the manufacturer or everyone should be immune, and it's just a cost borne by the state when it conducts warfare.
So I guess a different way of framing my question is it just a different way of looking at a product's liability issue, just a different context?
So in some cases it might be. The U.S. military often immunizes the manufacturers of its weapons from tort law cases. So in order to provide incentives for them to continue to manufacture weapons. So that might not fly in the U.S. legal regime, but nonetheless, at the international level, the United States as an entity could still be held accountable, let's say, for the bombing of this hospital and pay, under a legal regime, pay appropriate compensation to the victims.
Rebecca, you mentioned the systems in place in the demilitarized zone in between South and North Korea. Can you give us your take on what other systems are out there that might rise to the level of autonomous weapon systems?
Sure. So the Israeli Harpy is an anti-radar gun, aerial vehicle. The person launching it knows that it will likely target enemy radars, but they have no idea which enemy radars it's going to target when they launch it. And so for that reason, I think it's an autonomous weapon system insofar as after deployment, it can be in the air for, I think, 2.5 hours, during which time it searches for enemy radar signals. And if it finds one, sort of kamikaze bombs it and is destroyed in the process. Another initial for sort of first level autonomous weapon systems, there's a C-mine, and I am blanking on the name right now, PMZK, something like that.
Some appropriately militaristic acronym, I'm sure.
It has a lot of letters, but it is a sea mine used, I think, by Russia, and they sold it to China, that is, just sort of at sea, sitting there, non-active, until it's triggered by something. I'm not sure what, because all of this is fairly classified, but when it is triggered, it releases a missile that will then seek out and engage a target. But it's not known, obviously, by the person who deploys it, what kind of, you know, what target it's going to eventually engage. That one's a little bit more akin to a traditional landmine. It does seem to have some more autonomous capabilities than a traditional landmine in terms of the calculations and the algorithms it uses to determine when to release a missile. But that would be, I would consider, a pretty rudimentary autonomous weapon system. Other systems like the US Aegis system, which is a close-in missile system, it identifies, it's used on ships in the US Navy and has been for about 30 years. And it identifies incoming threats and eliminates them. So incoming threats could be missiles, incoming airplanes, etc. And it has four modes. And it is primarily used in the first three modes, all of which require some amount of human involvement. But it also has a fourth mode, I think it's termed casualty mode, under which it presumes that all of the human operators are disabled or incapacitated in some way or another, and it can independently identify incoming threats and engage them.
That's terrifying.
All right. Yeah. So it's good to know that these things are out there. Let's get back to talking about, obviously, these systems are just going to become more sophisticated and more deadly as time goes on. Go ahead, Emma.
Can I jump in there? I'm sorry. I just wanted to know, you brought up the idea that, you know, these things are software modes where, you know, the first three modes are not autonomous, but the fourth mode could be switched on and could be autonomous. And you also said that we're not entirely sure of the capabilities of some of these devices because it's classified. My question is, I guess, is there any way that we would know or be able to know if some of these devices that are just sort of software locked were turned on? Or is it just sort of up to watchdog organizations and, you know, whistleblowers?
Not even watchdog organizations, frankly.
Oh, great.
I mean, you think about it. The difference between a semi-autonomous drone, one that is remotely operated by a human operator, and a fully autonomous drone that, you know, both of which identify a target and bomb that target.
That's like an Xbox controller difference, right? Like,
how can you tell from the outside which one is autonomous and which one's being controlled by a human being? This is a huge problem for enforcement, both of a complete ban on autonomous weapon systems, just insofar as how do you know when the ban has been violated? And I've done a brief historical study of different weapons bans and when they're successful, when they're not. And one of the traits that's really contributes to a weapons ban being successful is the ability to identify violations so that you can then jump in and punish or shame the country that has violated its commitment. Mm-hmm. That's not going to apply here. But that's also a problem for regulations, right? That's a ban is sort of the most extreme form of regulation, but it's also going to be very difficult just for a regulatory treaty to identify when it's been violated. If all states agree to have X level of human supervision, how do you tell that? You know, states generally don't like sharing the inner workings of their militaries.
Is this a losing battle then? I mean, it sounds like this is as inevitable of a solution, as inevitable as anything else. Like, it feels like you're trying to stop copyright violation, to be honest. Like, at the end of the day, any government wouldn't be able to, or would be able to just lie about it.
So maybe I've miscast my stance on this. I am not for a ban on autonomous weapon systems. I think for a variety of reasons, Not only is it highly unlikely to be successfully negotiated, not only is it highly unlikely to be effective if it's negotiated and ratified, I think it has the potential to really retard some useful progress in weapons development. That there, as much as sort of we've been talking about the sort of scary aspect, the sort of visceral scary aspect of being potentially targeted by autonomous weapon systems, there's a lot of potential for improved distinction between lawful and unlawful targets, and a lot of possibility of improvements in terms of they reduce risk both to the soldiers and on military using them and possibly even to the civilians on the other end, insofar as they might be better able to distinguish between lawful and unlawful targets. So I'm not convinced that even if we could ban, that would be a good idea. And I don't think we can ban.
So this sounds like a good a way for you to further explain that would be to talk a bit about permanently blinding lasers and how this is not necessarily a parallel situation. First of all, tell us about permanently blinding lasers and how those are being treated.
Okay, so for this, I feel like I should pull up the exact language because that's important. All right, the 1995 protocol, the fourth protocol to the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, which to my mind is one of the worst named treaties ever.
The Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons?
Yes.
Oh, I love our government.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
sorry.
That's the international community, right?
Even
there.
Better.
So it prohibits laser, quote, I'm quoting now, laser weapons specifically designed as their sole combat function or as one of their combat functions to cause permanent blindness to unenhanced vision. And right now, there are 104 state parties to this protocol. And I believe there's no recorded violations of it. So in that way, it is by far the most successful weapons ban of all time. right? That definitely beats the ban on crossbows and submarines. Right. So what makes this ban so successful? I think first I should say... This ban is commonly cited by those advocating for a ban on autonomous weapon systems as an example of, hey, it is actually possible to ban a weapon systems and have all these states agree to banning it and to have that ban be effective. So it's an example that it's possible, which is a big first hurdle, right? Mm-hmm. And it's also cited because it's one of the very few preemptive bans. States banned permanently blinding laser weapons before they had ever been deployed in combat. And so a lot of the proponents for a ban on autonomous weapon systems also would argue that we don't have autonomous weapon systems yet, that the weapon systems I named are more automated than autonomous, or they're human supervised, so they're not autonomous. I already gave my reasons for why I disagree with that assessment, but they present autonomous weapon systems often as weapons of the future that we should ban now. And so the ban on permanently blinding lasers is really appealing to people making that argument for both of those reasons. I think it fails as precedent for a lot of important reasons. One is, the ban is so narrowly tailored and specific. It bans weapons that are specifically designed to cause permanent blindness. It does not ban weapons that happen as a side effect to cause permanent blindness. Mm-hmm. That's important. There are a number of those weapons in use. Secondly, it allows the military that wants to accomplish a certain objective to still accomplish that objective. If the military wants to blind enemy forces, it can. It just has to only temporarily blind them. As long as it's not permanent blindness, that's fine. That's lawful. And so, for example, the U.S. used what they called dazzlers, I believe in Iraq, to cause temporary blindness at checkpoints. This was lawful because they weren't permanently blinding. And so the military can still accomplish the same exact objective and be in compliance with this particular ban. Great, you pulled that up. and so... This is entirely different from autonomous weapon systems. Autonomous weapon systems, rather than being narrowly tailored and very specific, encompass a broad range of different types of weapons, weapons that exist in the air, on the sea, on land. There's a strong argument that the most likely and prolific form of autonomous weapon systems are going to be cyber autonomous weapon systems. They can do all sorts of different things, and they can do it at superhuman speeds. They are uniquely effective at accomplishing certain tasks. Let's say acting in defense. They can identify and eliminate an incoming threat long before a human being even knows there's a danger. And so because they're uniquely effective, unlike permanently blinding lasers, which, you know, dazzlers make them not uniquely effective, and because states don't even know all the potentials for how they might be able to use them, I don't think states are going to be willing to ban something where they don't recognize the potential of it yet. Just to give an example of that, states were willing to ban aerial bombardment. So they put a 5-year moratorium on aerial bombardment before the invention of the airplane. Once the airplane was invented, that ban failed. And it was largely because states recognized, wow, there's a whole lot we can do here. We're not willing to continue with a ban on something we haven't explored all the implications of. Permanently blinding lasers, the narrowness and the specificity of that makes it easy to ban, you know, from states looking forward, saying, well, this doesn't really hamper us or put us at a loss compared to other states who might not agree to sign on to the ban. That's the other important thing to remember, is that all of international treaty law, and that's how weapons bans usually start as treaty law, is entirely voluntary. So states choose whether or not to forego or give up certain types of weaponry. And over time, these treaty laws can sometimes become customary law, which is binding on all states. I think there's a very strong argument that the ban on the use of chemical weapons has now become customary international law. But it's certainly initially for autonomous weapon systems, you're going to need state commitment to have an effective ban. And I just think the ban on permanently blinding lasers is not a good precedent for that.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break here to thank our sponsor of this episode of This Week in Law, which is Braintree. Thank you so much, Braintree, for sponsoring This Week in Law. It is code for easy mobile payments. Now, you could be working on the next Uber, Airbnb, or GitHub, or you could be in any sort of business in today's world. There's no reason why you wouldn't want to use the same simple payment solution that helped all of those great companies become what they are today. Just the other day, I was speaking with an unsolicited person who came by my door attempting to get us to sign up for a service. And we were talking about their service and, you know, if I were to sign up, how this was going to work. And they, like so many vendors that I continue to encounter, thought that we would set this up where they would come and I would write them a check. I just can't imagine, and I think I speak for a lot of consumers, that people are still building business models where they come in and their consumers write them a check. I really don't have that many checks left in my life and don't plan to order a lot more. I think I have maybe a handful left in my checkbook, and they've been sitting there for months and months, because writing a check today seems like the wrong way to pay. You need mobile payments for your customers, and mobile payments are fast, easy, and seamless with Braintree, so much so it's almost magical. You can add it to your app, which hopefully you've got one of those too, with just a few lines of code, and you're instantly ready to accept Apple Pay, Android Pay, PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, even Bitcoin. In other words, you're not relying on your customers to make sure they still have a few checks left in their checkbook. And if some other way to pay comes along that customers are really going to enjoy, then Braintree is going to support that too. Braintree's fast payouts and continuous support mean you'll always be ready, whether you're earning your first dollar or your billionth. You'll see fewer abandoned carts too, and more sales with Braintree's best-in-class mobile checkout experience. Braintree gives you a full stack payment solution, support for all payment types your customers might want, single integration across all platforms with superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts. You really need to check it out for yourself, and you can do so by visiting braintreepayments.com/twill. Thank you so much, Braintree, for making businesses get paid conveniently, get paid faster, and making life easier for consumers as well, and for supporting This Week in Law. All right. Before we move on, I think we should put our first MCLE passphrase into the show as well. Let's make it bad laser, based on the discussion we've just been having. And following up on that discussion, we're here with Rebecca Krutoff, Emery Roan, and me talking about killer robots. Rebecca, frankly, has been scaring the pants off me with a lot of discussion of the technology that is available today. I assume you guys are trembling as well, too. But it's not without hope, if I can discern that from what we've been talking about, that our systems are getting to the point where if we are going to have autonomous weapons systems roaming the world, and as Rebecca has laid out for us, we already in some ways do, that over time they're going to become more sophisticated and become able to do the job that we would like them to do, which is eliminate bad actors, bad guys, enemies, etc., with a minimal loss of life in the process. So tell us, Rebecca, what is the silver lining of having autonomous weapons systems in the world? What benefits will they bring us?
Well, I think some that I've already mentioned are, from a defensive standpoint, they are far superior to human operated weapon systems, right? That they can identify, you know, if you are on a ship and there's an incoming missile, that having the Aegis system or any one of those many different variants used by US allies or other states is far superior than having somebody just constantly monitoring the horizon. So certainly for defensive actions, they're great for troop protection. They have the potential, to the extent that they minimize the need for human soldiers, they reduce the amount of troops that are subjected to physical and psychological dangers. There is a lot of arguments that they are going to be more humane, or possibly more humane than human beings, because they will not be afflicted by many of the different emotions and frailties that human beings have. They don't get tired. They don't get hungry. They don't act out of a desire for vengeance. They don't act out of racism or sexism. That's asterisks on that for later.
Or empathy. Or kindness, or...
You are getting to the flip side, yes. So everything that you can say on one side, there's a flip side, right? So I'm just... You asked for the benefits, so I'm obviously presenting a one-sided view right now.
Thank you.
Yes, but no, certainly the flip side argument is all the traits that make people humane, that there are many cases in warfare where you have the ability to lawfully, under the law of war, kill somebody that individual human soldiers decide not to for various reasons, including empathy, including mercy, including just a respect for human life, even if it's not to the military advantage. So there's certainly a flip side. There's a bunch of really interesting questions around whether or not autonomous weapon systems and technology in warfare in general is going to make war easier. If politicians know that they are fielding a battalion of robotic troops, they're not going to feel this in a democratic society. They're not going to feel the same constraints about having to answer to their constituents. Should there have to be some coffins coming home, as they would if there was going to be some flag-draped coffins coming home. So on one side, there's an argument that's going to make war too easy, that important democratic check on waging war won't be there anymore the more we have technology substituting for human soldiers. There's also the argument that, well, in other cases, it might make war easier, and that might be a good thing insofar as maybe we'll see more humanitarian interventions. Maybe we'll see more willingness of states to intervene with force when there is a genocide going on, if they're not risking their own civilians, their own troops, their own nationals. All of these lead to larger questions about whether or not humanitarian intervention is a net good or net bad, and whether decreasing the bar for intervention is a net good or net bad. But these are some of the arguments in the debate.
Well, Emery mentioned, and you've been, I think, discussing kind of all along, a point that I think we need to make explicit here, and that is you could choose. There are a lot of people in the world who would like autonomous weapons systems not to exist at all, but that's not really a choice that we have. That people are going to make them. If there's a ban on them, maybe there will be fewer of them made, but as with copyright infringement or other things where people just ignore the ban that's in place, it'll get done, and it'll get done by perhaps folks with far less scruples than otherwise would happen. Do you agree that that's kind of the situation we find ourselves in?
Yeah, and actually, that's something I didn't really discuss in my blog post on why the permanently blinding laser ban wouldn't be a great precedent for autonomous weapon systems. But realistically, there was no civilian need to design and produce permanently blinding lasers. There was no push for that in the civilian sphere, whereas there's a huge push for increased machine autonomy in the civilian sphere, right? As evidenced by all the conversations on autonomous cars, on increased machine autonomy generally. I think I just saw something on Twitter the other day about how a hotel or a hospital is now going to have all of its staff be its receptionist robots. Anytime you call a customer service, chances are you're getting a very low level, very narrow AI talking with you. I mean, there's a huge push for machine autonomy domestically in the civilian sphere, and that's going to bleed over into the military, I believe.
Okay, so given that these systems are going to be developed, and we as a society, as a world, we'll have to make that decision. And it seems like people are trying to grapple with that decision, whether we're going to just accept that they're going to be developed or we're going to try and ban them. Are there countries that are actively arguing that these systems should be banned?
So I believe right now there are 14 countries that have called for a full ban on autonomous weapon systems. I don't have the complete list off the top of my head. I believe it includes Portugal, Pakistan, Cuba, the Holy See. None of these are military powerhouses. None of these are the countries that are likely to first be deploying autonomous weapon systems in large numbers. I don't believe the Holy See has a military. The countries that have sort of reserved judgment on a ban are, somewhat unsurprisingly, Israel, South Korea, the United States, United Kingdom, Germany walks the line, China, and Russia. So that's where I don't see a lot of state commitment to a ban from some of the more relevant militaries. The United Kingdom has explicitly said that it will oppose a ban on autonomous weapon systems.
Right.
You kind of set it up as a question of unregulated development versus a ban, which makes a ban look really appealing because we've all seen all the science fiction pieces and read all the science fiction books about the problems with unregulated development of AI. I think there's a middle path. I think it faces many of the enforcement problems of a ban, but that there's a higher likelihood of getting state involvement, and that is through regulation, through attempting to proactively channel the development of autonomous weapon systems and create standards and norms around how they are used and how they're deployed and regulate what it is impossible to ban, just as happened with nuclear weapons. There are a host of reasons why we were unable to ban nuclear weapons, despite a huge amount of civil society engagement and I think some much stronger arguments that they are inherently unlawful under the law of war than you have for autonomous weapon systems in terms of can they be discriminately used. But states were willing to regulate them. They were willing to regulate their testing. They were willing to regulate the materials necessary for them. Now, I don't want to fall into the same trap of using a bad precedent, because there are some architectural constraints on nuclear weapons that wouldn't apply to autonomous weapon systems, namely that they need certain materials and they're not widespread in civilian infrastructure, as I believe autonomy and weapon systems will be. But I think that there is some lessons to be gleaned from that it is sometimes possible to regulate, but you can't ban.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what kind of regulations do you see would be effective? I'm trying to think of any kind of regulation that couldn't just be rooted around with a software patch.
So, like I said, there's huge enforcement problems because of the non-visibility of whether or not something is autonomous or semi-autonomous. But I think, you know, the DoD's policy was an attempt to, and the decision to publicize it was an attempt to create a norm around how autonomous weapon systems should be used in a ethical and reasonable way. I think it was the Future of Life Institute recently issued an open letter calling for a ban on offensive autonomous weapon systems, and signed by a number of different preeminent individuals, Stephen Hawking, I believe, Steve Wozniak, I think Elon Musk might have been on there. And I think that's the right urge, right? To within the industry, within the people who are designing and creating these, to start to create some norms and some standards that are constraining. You know, Larry Lessig has his famous code is law, and you know, it's four different sources of law are you know, law itself, the market, the architecture of the technology, and norms. And norms play a huge role. And I think that through the development both of soft law and treaty law with regulations, there's the possibility to constrain how these are developed. And part of the point of my war torts piece is to argue for a sort of back-end accountability for the use of autonomous weapon systems that will hold states responsible for the actions of autonomous weapon systems in a way that might cause states to think about when and how they deploy them.
Is this sort of like analogous to, you know, mutually assured destruction, as like why, like the enforcement protocol behind the, you know, preventing the spread of nuclear weapons was the fact that we have a huge arsenal of nuclear weapons we can like wipe you off the face of the earth with. Can I leave that to you? What?
You're handing me all the hard questions.
Right.
I think the situation is different with autonomous weapon systems, that barring attaching nuclear weapons to them, it's not the same worldwide destructive potential as yet. You know, Skynet references notwithstanding. But you know, this is the hard work, right? Like, it's easy to sort of sit back and say, okay, this isn't going to work for this reason, this isn't going to work for that reason. I am, you know, trying to figure out what's going to work, but I don't have very clear, comforting answers for you right now.
Right. Well,
I'm definitely not trying to grill you on this. I'm just curious.
Oh, no, it's such a fascinating issue. And something you said earlier, Rebecca, made me think about, well, lots of things make me think about Star Trek, but a particular episode of Star Trek.
I want to point out, Lieutenant, yes. For all the bad fleck that, you know, autonomous weapon systems get and all the references to Terminator, like Lieutenant Commander Data would constitute an autonomous weapon system.
Hey.
Data as AWS.
That's
this
show
was
title.
Yes, original series Star Trek. There was you were talking about how you know, if you're sending a squadron of autonomous weapons into battle with another squadron of autonomous weapons, the loss of life becomes more negligible. You know, if what they're trying to accomplish is some sort of strategic goal that is not necessarily loss of life. But the episode that came to mind was, I forget what it was called now. Someone in IRC will tell me, but they encountered two worlds that were at war with each other and were electronically fighting the battle. They were sending simulated weapons at each other, at which point when a hit had been registered, a large number of people would have to walk into an incineration chamber and do away with themselves, because even though the war was virtual, each side had agreed, according to their crazy treaty, that people still had to actually die in order for this to play out. So I don't envision a world where that would actually happen, but you do raise the interesting specter of robots fighting robots and there being far less loss of life, so that people would be reluctant to get back into the more messy kind of warfare that we've become accustomed to on this planet. Do you think that that's a possibility as these continue to develop?
Well, your reference to that episode, mm-hmm. if you take out the people who then are incinerated and you just have mm-hmm. it robots fighting robots and the champion decides whatever political or legal dispute that was the cause of the war, let's say, mm-hmm. that really harkens back to the Middle Ages and, mm-hmm. Trial by combat, trial by champion, mm-hmm. what Whitman in a book called The Verdict of Battle. And that was a sort of a different international legal system where wars were used to as a way of deciding legal decisions. And so you didn't necessarily need the whole armies fighting each other. You just needed two individuals to go up against each other, whichever one won. Well, that sometimes decided the legal issue. And what you said sort of like made me imagine, right, the futuristic sort of full circle coming back to that. The nature right. of war has changed, obviously, since the Middle Ages in terms of what it means. That with the UN Charter and Article 2.4, war is now presumptively unlawful, that you need very specific reasons before you can enter into an armed conflict. And so that sort of robot versus robot deciding a dispute is not likely to play out in the same way. And I just don't think, right, in terms of how we think about war now, in terms of...
Right. Now, the point of the episode, and Virgil in IRC just gave me the title, it was called A Taste of Armageddon, was Kirk at the end ripping out their automated warfare systems and saying, if you guys are going to war with each other, you have to do it the old-fashioned way where, you don't know what your casualties are going to be and they're not acceptable losses, and you can't just sort of cleanly go send some people into a chamber and not have to deal with all the horror of war. So... I wonder if, as these systems begin becoming more a part of our lives, if the mutually assured destruction angle that Emery was getting at earlier isn't something along those lines, that people would become loath to engage in conventional warfare when other systems.
So it'd be like emotional distancing from the horrors
yes.
of war. Gotcha.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's
and I believe Mary Ellen O'Connell has made these arguments very strongly, both in the context of drone warfare, that it's problematic because you have this distancing, right? You don't have this sort of face-to-face interaction with the individual you're killing, and you're not actually confronted with the consequences of your actions, and applied that same reasoning to autonomous weapon systems to say that, there's something fundamental about taking another human being's life, that you can't distance yourself from it, and you can't just put layers of technology between yourself and that action. And then that's problematic.
Okay, let's talk about the technology for a bit, because right now, as AI stands in the world today, this topic of the inevitability of AI-driven autonomous weapons is particularly terrifying, because AI is in its infancy and most frequently talked about in the news when it gets things wrong, which it does a lot these days. So can you speak for a moment about the state of AI and its development?
Not with a great amount of expertise, no.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
My work primarily focuses on the law of war and the development of autonomous weapon systems. And I am, you know, I know what's out there and what's publicly available in terms of what they're capable of, but not so much what's going on behind the scenes. And then I know enough about AI to know I need to learn a lot more. And that's actually something I'm embarking on right now. Highly recommend Nick Bostrom's Superintelligence as a great introduction to the problems and the issues in the field.
Who was that? Nick? I'm sorry.
Nick Bostrom.
Nick Bostrom.
B-O-S-T-R-O-M. Yeah.
Good. Thanks for that. So, I mean, should we have regulations in place that somewhat put a halt or constraints on development of these systems until we're more comfortable with where the AI folks have gotten things?
So a moratorium.
Yeah.
That, I think there's a lot of strong arguments for a moratorium. Christoph Heinz, who is a special rapporteur for the UN, one of the first to investigate and publish on the issue of autonomous weapon systems, that was his ultimate recommendation, was that we just need some breathing space. We need a bunch of states to pause and think about what we're doing before we do it. And I think that's a great idea. I think there are so many difficult, unanswered legal questions, not, you know, just focusing on the legal, putting aside the strategic, the political, the moral, the ethical questions, that it would be great if we could get states to agree to stop and think about. And that, to some degree, has been what states have been trying to do. They haven't put forward a formal moratorium, but there are meetings, annual meetings. I think there's now been 3 or 4 of them, intergovernmental group of experts on lethal autonomous weapon systems, with representatives from over 100 states attending and discussing these issues and trying to wrap their heads around them. And this was really, this movement and these conversations were really, credit is due to both the U.S. Department of Defense for publishing its policy on autonomous weapon systems and really kicking off the conversation, and to Human Rights Watch and the Harvard International Human Rights Clinic, which almost immediately, either right before or right after, published a sort of working paper called, I think, The Case Against Killer Robots, really teeing up a lot of these questions that have, you know, sort of been the focus of discussion for the past 3 or 4 years. So there's a conversation happening now at the international level among states, representatives from civil society, representatives from the industry, that I think has the potential to coalesce into a lot of really useful norms and regulations as consensus is reached on different issues. A moratorium would be nice. There hasn't been evidence of that yet, in part because I think efforts are slightly misdirected into calling for a ban. A lot of the people who would be happy with a moratorium would be much happier with a ban, and so they're focusing their energies on that. But I think, yes, it's a very long answer when the answer is very short. Actually, it's just, yes, I think a moratorium could be incredibly useful.
Could be, yeah. We have a few examples of AI in the news lately. We never talked about this last week, did we, Emery? The Sunspring film, the film made by the AI. Yeah.
We talked about it before the show, but didn't have time to bring it up.
Right, so let's bring it up. This was a film that debuted on Ars Technica and is this hysterical movie starring, it was created by an AI that named itself Benjamin, wrote out a script. They have, what's the name of the actor from Silicon Valley? He is one of the actors in this film. I can't make myself watch Silicon Valley. Actually, yeah. I have the same response to it that I had to Curb Your Enthusiasm. It just makes me cringe and want to turn away. I understand it's a good show, and the actor seems quite competent.
but he's in this film, and you really just have to look it up. It's called Sunspring. It is a short science fiction movie written entirely by an AI. And let's see, his name is Thomas Middleditch. That's even better than Cumberbatch. Also, Elizabeth Gray is in the film, and Humphrey Kerr. And the dialogue is somewhat comical, but the actors really take it and make it, through their performances, something that's kind of cohesive, and you sort of can figure out what the story is by the way they acted out, or at least one version of the story. Did you take a look at it, Emery, and do you have any thoughts?
I actually haven't gotten a chance to watch it yet. I don't have any thoughts. I just thought it was, my only thought is that this is super interesting, and I want to watch it.
Right. So we have movies by AI. We obviously have chatbots
I'll just jump in on that, because I just had the opportunity to watch that a couple days ago. And it's worth noting what kind of AI it was, right? There's so many different kinds of artificial intelligence, and that was an algorithm that's accustomed to predicting how something's going to go based on what you start typing. Like when you start typing something into a text message and it predicts your next word, I believe it was that same sort of algorithm that was used to create this movie. And so what they did is, you know, in the same way that those text message algorithms sort of become specialized to the person who's using a given phone, right? They know what that person usually puts next. This algorithm was fed a bunch of science fiction screenplays. And so in some ways it's predicting what a science fiction screenplay would say next the entire way through, which brings up all kinds of classic tropes from science fiction. And that's why it feels in some ways like, even though sometimes the language is just ludicrous, the themes really in some ways feel a lot like a classic sci-fi movie, because it's building off of all of that.
Yes, it's on a space station. There's some sort of secret plot going on, and you're really not sure what, but the characters are all at odds with each other because of it. Is the kind of AI, that kind of predictive AI, clearly that has applications for what we've been discussing. We want autonomous weapons systems having excellent predictive capabilities, right?
Yeah, and there's definitely a move towards incorporating machine learning with autonomous weapon systems and sort of training programs so that different systems can be trained and then such that their reactions are going to be more predictable. No military wants to deploy a completely unpredictable system with the capability to use lethal force that's not only unlawful, that's potentially dangerous to your own troops. And so they're using machine learning to sort of both increase the lawfulness of the actions of autonomous weapon systems and to make their actions more predictable.
So distinguish that kind of AI, if you could, from something that you linked to on Twitter that I noticed. There was an AI that put, it was a hive mind AI called UNU. UNU, that decided to answer, well, it decided, someone set it up.
Already anthropomorphizing.
That's right. It was set loose on Reddit and asked to answer questions about U.S. politics. Is there anything we can learn from that experience?
All right, so UNU is an entirely different kind of AI that is based on the idea that, you know, sort of two minds are better than one, and a whole hive mind is going to be better than any individual. And they tout their success in, predicting the winners in the Kentucky Derby and I don't know, maybe the Oscars or something. But by and large, that AI is completely based on human intelligence, right? It's just consolidating human intelligence. They get a bunch of human beings together and they ask that group a question. And based on the speed with which that group comes to an answer, and they all do it individually, I think by sort of, you know, sliding a cursor towards whatever answer they want, kind of like a Ouija board, that's the percent of confidence that is registered on whatever answer ends up being arrived at. I think UNO is put together by a group called Unanimous AI, and they have stated that they're concerned about machine intelligence insofar as it's not going to incorporate human ethics and human morals in the ways that we think of them influencing decision making, and that this form of artificial intelligence, the hive mind approach, is a way of reaching decisions through through AI, but incorporating human morals in that decision making process.
Okay, so back to empathy and kindness. Is there a military tie-in for this kind of AI?
That's a really interesting question. I don't know. I imagine not at the lower levels of action. I would be curious, and I would like to think about that at a sort of operational strategic command.
Yeah, like a swarm AI-driven, tactics like that. Whoa.
Right. If you consolidate the brains of all the best generals, right, and have them reach a decision, is that always going to be a better decision than any one general acting independently? I bet, Unanimous AI would probably say yes. But
right. Yeah.
So I know in the Unanimous AI Reddit thread, one of the first and second and third like top responses or questions were asking it, of course, to predict Trainwreck 2016. And I know that it answered with, 86% confidence or something that Hillary Clinton would win, or that Hillary Clinton was corrupt, or that Bernie Sanders was not corrupt. I mean, these are all obviously reflections of the swarm that they're pulling from, but they sort of reflect that also the fear of, biases and discrimination in algorithms and in AI. I know that there is a lot of, concern about that specifically with, algorithms that we're going to talk about later with like data mining and, fingerprint databases. But is there a similar recognition of the problem that algorithm bias can have with these kind of AIs? And I guess taking that even further, has that even been talked about for autonomous weapon systems?
Yes, I think there is that realization. I think it is growing. I think there's always, it's growing in a lot of different fields, right? There's an increasing discussion of predictive policing, and alongside that discussion, a discussion of the role of bias in the data sets that are being used by these predictive algorithms. I think, I said earlier when I was listing off the pros touted by those who want to promote autonomous weapon systems, a couple of which is that they won't be sexist, right? They won't be racist. They're not going to rape. There's a huge asterisk there because they are going to be however they're programmed to be.
Right.
And if it's incredibly difficult to remove bias from our data sets, from the data sets that are collected by bias systems. And so as long as you're going to have bias in the data set and you're not actively figuring out a way to eliminate or combat that bias, it's going to translate into whatever system it's then, being used in. So there's a possibility not only that autonomous weapon systems will be racist and sexist, if intentionally, there's a possibility that they would be racist and sexist entirely unintentionally.
Mm-hmm.
I think Charlie Carpenter has a great blog post about, I think she calls it the myth of how robots won't rape, that mm-hmm. I'd recommend
that
checking out.
That is a blog title if I've ever heard one. Awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. More terror in our lives here from the mindlessly badly programmed autonomous weapon system. The other sort of terrible scenarios, there are obviously good scenarios and bad scenarios when we talk about this topic. So we're trying to be even-handed about it. But there are a couple of dangers, right, that have to do with how one obtains their autonomous weapons, sort of going from what you said, who programs them, who provides them, who is able to get their hands on them.
Our AR-15s are in the discussion. Are we going to be able to start buying our own, you know, little cyborg, you know, bodyguard?
Yeah, I don't see why. I mean, militarily, the militaries of the world are certainly not the only people who have weapons. So once this technology is available for the military, I'm sure that there will be private enterprises marketing them privately, or even if, you know, on the interim step to that future, there will be the ability to lay your hands on military grade autonomous weapon systems that maybe were never intended to be in the hands of that party. Any thoughts on that at all, Rebecca?
So I think that's where there's some possibility of successful regulation of autonomous weapon systems, insofar as, well, it's a mixture. I'm like second guessing myself as I start to answer that. On one hand, there's going to be a lot of interest in by the militaries who are developing these systems to keeping the first mover advantage, to being the only military with these autonomous weapon systems of different levels of capability. And so I think the more advanced ones, it might be relatively easy to minimize their proliferation. On the complete other hand, and this is where I started second guessing myself, mm-hmm. to the extent that machine autonomy becomes more common in the civilian sphere, it's going to be very easy to weaponize. And I guess something worth pointing out here is we're talking a lot about autonomous weapon systems and that they're scary because they're autonomous. But that introduces a lot of hard legal questions. But in terms of the civilian sphere, semi-autonomous systems could be equally as scary. I think there's a lot of concern about autonomous cars insofar as you could very easily turn them into bombs and instruct them where to go. And then they would detonate with no one needing to be the suicide bomber in that bombing. That these increasing capabilities of different technological systems to operate on their own offer opportunities for weaponization.
That was one of the first things, given the week in which we're recording this show, that was one of the first things I thought of as we were getting ready for the show is, you know, what happens when you have, you know, whether it's a fanatical terrorist zealot or someone acting for other purposes who wants to wreak a lot of mayhem and they have access to this kind of weaponry, that, you know, the outcome could be even worse than what we saw in Orlando earlier this week. We're not just talking about, you made the distinction early on in the show, weapons that can make their own decisions. I guess even a weapon that was being remotely controlled by someone would be extremely dangerous in that kind of scenario. So something that our regulators will have the happy job of having to come to terms with. As far as systems that are making decisions on their own, one thing that Google DeepMind is working on is a kill switch. Have you looked at this at all, Rebecca? And do you have thoughts on, I mean, obviously a kill switch seems like a good idea. The problem seems to be that no AI worth its salt is going to want to implement its kill switch. So what do we do about that?
So I did have a chance to read some of the posts that you highlighted. Mm-hmm. I have to say, as a non-specialist, I'm just so glad that they are working on this, that this seems I would expect them to be thinking about it and to be concerned about it. And I think the amount of, you know, time and energy that can be put towards developing kill switches is inexhaustible. I have read too many science fiction stories where that does not work to be entirely comforted. It's basically my understanding is that they're teaching through a sort of machine learning process. They're teaching robotic systems, algorithmic systems, to see human interventions and to see a kill switch as part of its own its internal processes and goals, and therefore not detrimental to its ultimate goal or ultimate mission, and therefore not something to fight, which seems like a clever approach. I hope it works.
Me too. Any thoughts on kill switches, Emery?
No. I'm right there with you. It sounds like act one of the sci-fi movie, like right before we find out it doesn't work.
Or you see like on the news feed, they develop a kill switch for killer robots, and we can all
Someone in the chat is saying kill switch to tell the robots to kill. Like, oh, you wanted me to stop? Why did you call it a kill switch then?
All right. We are making kill switch fail our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases into the show in case you are a lawyer or other person who is listening to the show in hope of obtaining professional credit in your field. For lawyers, we have a little chart of the 50 United States and how you might go about applying to get credit for listening to This Week in Law. We're watching it, of course. You can go to wiki.twit.tv, find our show page there, and you'll find that handy-dandy chart to give you some assistance. So kill switch fail is our second phrase for this show. All right. Any final thoughts on the topic of semi-autonomous or fully autonomous weapon systems before we move on to something that might actually be related on the privacy front?
I just, right now, my sort of general recommended takeaway message is that autonomous weapon systems I think they're here. I think they're in existence, but they are almost undoubtedly going to be in existence shortly, and that there is an opportunity to proactively channel their development through legal regulation and other kinds of regulation, norm building and standard setting, and that this is something that we need to pay attention to now, that international law is fluid and it can be influenced.
Yep. And I'm glad there are very smart people like you who are writing about, thinking about, wrapping your head around these complicated issues and carrying on the discussion so that hopefully we don't find ourselves in that post-Terminator world that you always get referred to when people bring you on shows like this. Any final thoughts, Emery?
No. I think that this is going to be relevant for our privacy discussion about, you know, recognizing the need for regulation early.
Yes, let's talk about privacy. So somewhat along the same lines, the lines of how good our systems do, how well our systems do the tasks that we task them with, we learned this week there was an audit, right, from the Government Accounting Office of an enormous database maintained by the FBI that has over, 411 million images combed from other state databases. It's the central repository for every time you have to take a photo for some government-related thing, the FBI has a record of it. And claims to be able to use it productively, but hasn't been disclosing a lot about how it works or what its safeguards are. And Emery, tell us more.
All right. So a little bit of background here. Last year in 2015, the FBI quietly rolled out an upgrade or an update to their previous automated fingerprint identification system, the AFIS. Now, depending on which part of the various press releases you read from the FBI, they will characterize this either as a monumental generational leap or an incremental upgrade. But
what it is they expanded on the AFIS to incorporate a huge amount of different biometric information, not just thumbprints and fingerprints, but hand geometry, latent hand prints, facial geometry, iris scanning. This is the same database that holds the tattoo database or tattoo recognition that was also making some news last week at the EFF. But effectively, they not only expanded the technical capabilities that the AFIS had, but they also expanded the scope of people that would be sort of scooped up in it, the scope of the type of records that would be scooped up in it. And they also changed the protocol around who exactly has access to this database. And that was last year. They just rolled out they started using it. Of May of this year, May 5th of this year, the FBI finally released a privacy report on the NGI. So for a lot of advocates and advocacy orgs, that was sort of the first we had really heard about it, was back in May. And so we've sort of been scrambling behind the scenes privacy rights. I know that a handful of other organizations that have sort of written comments about this. And earlier this week, the United States Government Accountability Office released a report that looked at the FBI's rollout of this service. And so what they found was that, first off, they reported on it. So, you know, they report on the sheer number and quantity of databases of entries that they have. So like you said, it was more than 400 million individual images combed from, every time you get your license taken at the DMV at certain states, anytime you want to get a background check. The NGI, by the way, I can link it in our show notes to the actual FBI's report on it. But we're talking about a huge number of people. Not only is this criminal prints, but these are people that are getting their fingerprints or biometrics done for background checks, for any kind of visa work that needs to be done, any kind of contracting work that you're doing with the government. If you're in the criminal law department, if you're contracted to work with certain criminal law agencies. So it's a pretty huge, dramatic expansion. And the GAO found that, well, not only is this a thing that we should be concerned about, but the FBI also refused to publish certain privacy impact assessments over the years. The GAO pointed out that this was being talked about, I think, as early as 2011. And they also point out that there's serious efficacy questions about the usefulness of the technologies that they have. So while we are scraping, millions and millions and millions of, data points, are these actually being used or are they actually useful? A whole other side of that effect is that the just like what we were talking about with, machine bias and algorithmic bias and discrimination, these effects or the changes to the AFIS system to NGI in expanding the scope of people that are scooped up affect minorities more than otherwise. So anytime you need an immigration issue, there's a lot of potential here to have really discriminatory effects is the long and the short of it. And it's a pretty fundamentally creepy system, I think. We already had reports last year of individual state LEOs being given access to it, which obviously they shouldn't. Oh, and I'm sorry to be monologuing, but just to top it all off, as part of the FBI's report, they are trying to exempt the NGI from certain privacy-protecting provisions of the Privacy Act. So as a consumer, as a citizen, you wouldn't be able to know that your information is in the database. You wouldn't be able to know who or if or when it was ever accessed. You wouldn't be able to go back and correct data that was in there, and you wouldn't be able to get your data out of there. So it's the creation of this really monumental, sweeping biometrics database that has really little oversight right now, that people are just sort of becoming aware of, and that, just like what we were talking about, the need to sort of establish norms early. Biometric data is super scary, personally. This is stuff that you can't revoke. It's going to be, the same all your life. Right. Ignoring the idea that, if this data gets into bad actors' hands, if, we have another 300 million, IRS data breach, mm-hmm. What happens to all of that information? Ignoring that question, the potential for abuse purely in our own country by our own government is pretty alarming, I think. So
I've been wanting to talk about this for a few weeks. I don't think there's much more to talk about.
I'll give you something.
Sweet.
Because I'm glad you raised the potential for abuse, the potential for disparate treatment of different people within the database. But I'm talking about what scares me more than any sort of abuses or overreaching is the government trying to use it in ways that we would approve of, but just without adequate technological tools to do so. I mean, they're relying on facial recognition to be accurate, which, mm-hmm. you know, hopefully the government has better systems than Google or Facebook has. I don't know. I mean, I think we could question that, but the facial recognition yeah. that you see in the wild in the private sector, while fun and a novelty and, you know, accurate in a number of instances, is far from universally accurate. And yeah. and I've got to think that the government is in the same kind of situation, so that, you know, they're trying to match people up, but they're getting false positives.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's what the GAO report found, was that, you know, for a lot of this, there's no real evidence that these are particularly useful. I think, it mirrors the situation we have in general with privacy, where a lot of our government agencies have taken the approach of, well, even if this data isn't useful to us now, let's collect it all and it should be useful to us later. You know, this is why, even though, you know, we have FBI watch lists, that the Orlando shooting wasn't prevented. This is, you know, we have so much data that our government can't use it. But at the same time, the potential for abuse and the potential not only for abuse in the future, but abuse now is there. And yeah, it's scary.
All right. Well, thanks for bringing this to our attention. It's and thanks to Senator Franken. And was not the EFF also involved in mm-hmm. Urging this audit to be done?
Yeah.
So EFF continues.
Good job,
continues.
Al Franken. Keeps being
yes,
the
exactly.
coolest senator that was ever on Saturday Night Live.
That's right. Rebecca, any thoughts on this before we move on?
I mean, there's sort of, right, there's a quick connection to be made with, is this going to be used in conjunction with weaponry, right? Like, are mm-hmm. we going to have weapon systems that are targeted assassins? And this is sort of the Terminator idea, right? Like, you will mm-hmm. go kill John Connor.
Hey, you brought it up this time. We didn't.
I know. but in part to make the point that you know, people talk about autonomous weapon systems being scary. Semi-autonomous weapon systems are just as scary. I think the Terminator is a semi-autonomous weapon system.
He was sent back.
He was sent back to kill a specific target. He didn't select his own target. Its own mm-hmm. target, right? Skynet there is the autonomous weapon system. And,
right.
and Terminator is the semi-autonomous weapon system. So even if you have target selection being made by humans, I mean, using algorithms that have these either, you know, inherent biases or, like you brought up, inherent problems and malfunctions, mm-hmm. that's scary too when you incorporate it with weaponry.
Yep.
Right.
No argument here.
back to that moratorium idea. I don't know. Gosh, I'm sounding like Donald Trump. Let's put a moratorium until we figure it all out. No, that can't be the right answer. I don't know. Maybe it is in this situation.
I don't know. It's scary because, yeah. you know, the yeah. it goes back to the same situation with autonomous weapon systems and how effective any kind of regulation would be. You know, there is if we're talking about things that have a huge consumer interest, facial recognition, you know, is being driven by consumer interests. There's huge amounts of money to be made there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's going to happen. It's coming. It's here today.
Right. All right. One bit of news in case you missed it this week on the legislative and policy front. So you'll remember way back when the FCC enacted its latest version of the open internet rules that there was an immediate appeal taken to the Second Circuit. Is it the Second Circuit or the D.C. Circuit who just decided this? Emery, do you remember off the top
gosh.
Of your head?
Oh,
off God.
Off the top of my
know.
Head, I don't, but I'm pulling it up.
Hold on. It's the D.C. Circuit, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. I don't know. I had a little moment of spacing out there, but I'm pretty sure it's D.C. Circuit. Yes, here we go. D.C. Circuit on Tuesday decided the fate of the open internet rules
And what they have decided is that mobile broadband is properly characterized by the FCC as a telecommunications service and not just an information service. That gives the FCC some broader rights to do what they want and more authority for its open internet rules, which so far, and if anyone wants to read this decision, I believe it's upwards of 180 pages long.
Yep.
So have fun doing that. we will go through the entire long and convoluted history of regulation in this area. But the impact of the shoe that dropped this week is the open internet rules that have been most recently enacted are valid. The FCC had the authority to enact them, according to this court. And there will be more to come because the ISPs, et cetera, will definitely ask the Supreme Court to take a look at this decision and see if it agrees. And it will be up to the Supreme Court to decide whether it wants to do so. Emery, anything to add?
Yeah, just a little bit here. You know, on this issue, I think we are all right to be sort of cautiously optimistic about the state of net neutrality. You gave an excellent, background for all of our listeners from last year about the open internet order. This is just the appeal of that order. And yeah, you know, the courts came down and said that the FCC did have authority to regulate. The regulations were constitutional and they followed proper procedure. Now, this is, I've seen sort of mixed reactions to this. Some people are saying that, this could be appealed to the Supremes for one. This isn't a done deal. And that certainly could happen. The other thing that could happen is, of course, depending on how Trainwreck 2016 turns out in November, we could have a new Tom Wheeler. And if we have a replacement for Tom Wheeler, then these FCC rules could just go out as easily as they came in. What we really need is Congress to pass a law affirmatively setting these net neutrality rules. But that being said, this case is still pretty important because if the net neutrality rules do stand, it allows the FCC to take a more active role in regulating internet providers than they have already. So, for example, at Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, we've been working on reply comments to some FCC rules that were proposed last month or maybe the month before that, that because the open internet order classifies internet access as a utility rather than a luxury, would allow the FCC to require BIAS providers, broadband internet access service providers, to follow the same privacy protecting guidelines that telephone service providers have to follow that is laid out in the Telecommunications Act. So effectively, because prior to the open internet order, BIAS providers were regulated under the FTC as opposed to the FCC. They had a self-regulatory framework for privacy protection issues. The Communications Act required anyone that was giving telephone services to do things like, have restrictions on how you can sell your users, personal information, how much, what kind of ways you can share your data with third-party advertisers. These are restrictions that the BIAS providers have just simply not had to follow up until now because they've been under the self-regulatory FTC framework. So as someone that has been spending the past 2 weeks reading hundreds of pages from industry telecoms opposing these kind of what I think are common sense privacy protecting rules, this is great. This is very encouraging. Certainly one of the primary arguments that a lot of industry was saying was that the open internet order is the only way that the FCC would have jurisdiction over this and that may not stand up in court. So the open internet order, at least so far, is looking okay. There's still other arguments that, Verizon, Comcast are putting forward about why they don't have to protect their consumers' privacy. But the net neutrality rules, the idea that internet is now under the FCC, it really allows the FCC to sort of play the role of a more powerful policeman on the block that could hopefully bring some of the more egregious privacy violations and sort of questionable activities that BIAS providers have done into the light. So,
right. Something to pay attention to. You mentioned Congress possibly getting involved to codify net neutrality to give it not just a
regulatory agencies' approval. And as you point out, the people in charge of regulatory agencies can shift and do shift over time. So Congress might get involved in that way. They might also get involved on the side of the ISPs, because what this decision really comes down to is the difficulty in interpreting laws as they currently exist and you know, shoehorning the services that we see today into existing legislative definitions, like information service provider versus telecommunications service provider, when everything has gotten far less clear about the distinctions laid out, you know, years and years ago as to what those are supposed to encompass. So you could see Congress coming in and saying, we know the D.C. Circuit has said this, that this definition of telecommunications service provider encompasses mobile broadband, but we're going to now enact a law to clarify that, no, that's not what we want to have happen. So that could be in our future too. So,
Everything is sort of in flux. That's why you've been seeing, is partially at least why you've been seeing BIOS providers really pushing into the set-top box market, for example. One of their arguments against having to protect the privacy interests of their consumers is that edge providers are not under the same regulations. So edge providers, and by that we mean the services that users eventually use the internet to get to. So we're talking like Facebook, Netflix, Google. Edge providers are not under FCC jurisdiction. They're still under FTC jurisdiction. So one of the arguments being pushed by industry is that this is going to create unequal regulations across. Why should AT&T have to protect their consumers' private information, but, for example, Google doesn't, even though Google may have their Fios service and AT&T may have their UVerse service. There's a lot of sort of flux in the market, but I am cautiously optimistic. I'm not someone that supports, useless regulation or regulations that are unenforceable, but there are some privacy interests that so far have just not been able to be heard. So, good job.
Oh. Yes, more to come on net neutrality, no doubt, as this case keeps winding its way through and the advocates on both sides continue making their points. Let us move on to our concluding segments of the show, starting with our animal selfie of the week. Our animal selfie of the week is actually a product this week that animal selfie has become such an integrated part of our culture these days that there is a site out of the UK that will sell you animal selfie bedding should you be so inclined. Again, we can split hairs as we often do in discussing animal selfies about what constitutes a true and valid animal selfie. These appear really to be more animal mugshots. animals arrayed in interesting attire in front of something that looks like something you would stand in front of if you were having a mugshot taken. But they are pretty cute. We do not know in the context of the animal selfie bedding whether the animals themselves are activating the shutter mechanism or perhaps some member of law enforcement is capturing these animal selfie mugshots. But this bedding is available if you are such a fan of animal selfies that you must have them on your sheets and pillowcases. So had to share that with you. Moving on to our tip of the week, sort of going to the privacy concerns and perhaps even the AI concerns that we've discussed earlier in the show. Our tips, again, distilling this down into a tip is not the easiest thing in the world, but what I wrote down was more reasons to create a health consistent, credit-worthy Facebook presence and question whether, you want to be very careful about how you are presenting yourself on social media. And, in the past that we've had many anecdotes of insurance carriers checking out an insured's social media presence to see if in fact, they were, should continue
receiving workers' comp insurance, for example, other kinds of ways where data about you that you're putting out in the world can be used against you by third parties. Here we have a startup out of the UK that has developed software for landlords that it lets them analyze a potential tenant's social media presence to see whether they would be a good tenant. So it looks for things like, gee, I'm feeling poor or have no money to see whether they are. I think we had a story not too long ago about sort of a creditworthiness analysis that this seems very similar to that analyzed social media. This company is called Score Assured. And one thing that it says in its defense, because obviously people have not been too happy about the notion that someone might be vetting them as a tenant by what they've put on social media. One of the representatives of that company says that, you know, there may be people who simply don't have a credit score yet and are shut out of the housing market for that reason. But if this would be just one metric that a landlord would use in connection with other things and making a judgment about whether to rent to that person, and if you could have them see that you have a good social media tenant assurance, then maybe that could help you get a place to live. Our tip of the week is just to be aware that your data that you're putting out there can be used for purposes that you never thought of, and maybe your tenant worthiness might be one of them. Any thoughts on this, Emery?
No, I mean, I think that I was probably, along with everyone else, pretty concerned when we saw this. It seems like a really easy way to allow tenant or landlords to discriminate. And I'm not really sure if I buy the argument that a tenant or a landlord rather would rent to someone that didn't have a good credit score, but that somehow posted good selfies. So
animal selfies, preferably. They could bring in their animal selfie sheets. Who would be a better tenant? Someone who showed up with animal mugshots on their sheets. All right, we have a couple of resources for you. One of them is a meeting coming up next Tuesday at UC Berkeley. It is a meeting of the Commission on Enhancing National Cybersecurity. This is a commission that was formed earlier this week, this year, in February of this year, by President Obama. The commission is meeting in Berkeley, and it's having what looks like an open meeting. All you need to do is RSVP if you'd like to attend. They're going from 9 in the morning till 5 o'clock in the afternoon at UC Berkeley at the Chevron Auditorium at the International House at Berkeley. So if you're in the Bay Area, this might be something you're interested in attending. They will have panels on addressing security challenges to the digital economy, collaborating to secure the digital economy, innovating to secure the future of the digital economy, and the Center for Long-Term Cybersecurity will give a briefing. So all stuff near and dear to the hearts of folks who listen to this show, I'm sure. So I wanted to highlight that for you. Also wanted to highlight for you a great resource if you are thinking about talking about the First Amendment. And it is a piece over at Popat written by Ken White called "Hello, You've Been Referred Here Because You're Wrong About the First Amendment." And let me just read you his introduction because it's so brilliant. "Welcome. Someone has referred you to this post because you've said something quite wrong about the First Amendment. I apologize for this impersonal approach to your mistake. I would prefer to offer you an artisanal response to your wrongness, something that would respect and celebrate the unique ways that you've taken one of the most fundamental aspects of our mutual civic heritage as Americans and shat your ignorance upon it. Unfortunately, there are quite a few of you and only one of me, and I'm busy and lazy. Also, quite frankly, I feel that if I have to explain these things to just one more person, I may go quite mad. I don't mean mad in the vaguely amusing, sympathetic, relatable ways that people expect from me. I mean mad in an uncouth and alarming sense that will likely result in my calamitous misuse of some implement residing in the dark marchlands between tool and weapon, such as
what
an
ads." A wordsmith.
I know, right? "Such as an ads. So, constrained as we are by this impersonal medium, let's discuss why you are completely wrong." And he goes on to highlight just two, and there are others, of the ways that people are commonly wrong about
the First Amendment, the first being who is allowed to not make speech abridging rights, and the second having to do with civil cases and whether civil lawsuits are employing government power such that they could be regulated by the First Amendment. So it's an entertaining and useful post because the First Amendment is hard for people to get their arms around, works and doesn't work. And I'm hoping for follow-up posts because there's definitely more to say. And also we have a third resource. Who added the White House AI meetings? And
so
would
that
you like
was me. To the extent you're interested in different public sessions on relevant topics, the White House has recently announced, and that they're holding different meetings on the future of artificial intelligence, different aspects of it. And if you actually scroll down that webpage, you can get a list of the dates and the different events. They've already had the one on legal governance and AI for the social good, but there are two upcoming ones on safety and control for artificial intelligence. I'm sure they'll be talking about kill switches there, and social and economic implications. So that's going to have a lot to do with what we were talking about like bias in data sets and such.
That looks awesome.
Great. Yes,
do you know if they're going to be webcasts? I'm always lamenting that all the cool stuff either happens in San Francisco or DC. It's really hard as a San Diego advocate to get into these webcasts.
I believe they're going to be live streamed. I don't know if they're putting up the materials.
Okay. Well, thanks.
Yes, thank you so much for that. This has just been a great discussion, a little bit terrifying, but very interesting and important to think about these things before we unleash the weapons of autonomous destruction upon the world.
The robots of war.
Yes, exactly. So I'm really glad that you could join us today. Rebecca, good luck. Have you already started as the executive director of the Yale Information Society Project?
No, I'll be beginning this August and looking forward to having a lot more of these kinds of conversations and discussions about all of the different issues that you touched on today.
Right.
Thank you both very much for the opportunity to be here and speak with you.
You're very welcome. Emery and I are familiar with the Yale ISP, and probably people who have listened to the show for a long time are, because we reference the great work that the Yale ISP does, and we often have people on who are associated with it. But could you give us a brief overview of the Yale ISP and the great work it does?
Yeah, sure. So the ISP is an independent research center at Yale Law School that focuses on a lot on the intersection between law and technology and the impact of the information society on our culture more generally. So our work spans everything from helping journalists with FOIA requests to writing academic articles on killer robots or privacy issues, and amicus briefs in different cases. It's sort of a general organization that does a lot of different kinds of work related to the topics that you tend to discuss on the show.
And just anecdotally, it had one of the very first law blogs that existed. As another person who had one of the very first law blogs, I was a big fan of the Yale ISP's blog back in the early 2000s when they were one of the first out there. So great contributions all around. Thank you so much for joining us today, Rebecca. It's been just a thrill and a pleasure and a little bit chilling to speak with you, but all good and important.
Oh, thank you as well. This has been great.
Emery, wonderful to chat with you again, too. Hopefully your summer is proceeding apace. Any news on the house hunt up in the Bay Area?
Still searching, but optimistic. It'll work out. I've got the hardest part is getting the job. I can find a house to live, right? That's right.
I don't know. San Francisco's a little bit tough of a housing market. Hopefully you haven't been putting anything too detrimental on your Facebook page lately. Won't be a problem. But good luck with it. And again, if anybody has a good San Francisco housing alternative they want to put in Emery's way, or if you want to get in touch with us about anything related to the show, what you thought of today's show, any follow-up questions that you have,
any suggestions you have for guests that we might invite on in the future, anything at all, just give us a shout. Emery is emery@twit.tv. I am Denise at twit.tv. We love to hear from you. Mike Keyes took the week off, but will be back with us. We're going to take a couple of weeks off here, little brief summer break, but we will be back on July 8th along with Mike. So you can email him as well, mike@twit.tv. Find us on Facebook. Find us on Google Plus. Tweet at us and let us know what's on your mind.
Please let us know if there's anything you want to hear. Let us know if there's any topics you want to hear about, any guests you want to have on the show. Come on. It's a two-way street.
Seriously, you people who send me tweets are so helpful because you basically make sure that I see the important stuff if I haven't had the chance to jump online and look at my regular sources in a particular day. I definitely see the things that you send me as notifications on Twitter. That's really, really helpful. Thank you for that. Thank you so much for joining us. If you've joined us at 11 o'clock Pacific time, that means you've played along while we recorded the show live. That's wonderful. We love it when you can do that. But don't worry, if you can't, you can find this episode and our entire past archive of shows at twit.tv/twill, along with some guidance as to the many, many ways that you can enjoy the show, including on iTunes. When we first started doing the show started out as an audio podcast, just distributed on the site and on iTunes, and quickly evolved with the network into the lovely video offerings that we have on iTunes and elsewhere. Emery reminded me that we should remind you, if you are an iTunes listener, to go and rate us and give us your thoughts there. Really rate us and give us your thoughts however, wherever you listen. I think you can do that on Roku. I know you can do it on YouTube. So we do appreciate that if you care enough about the show to give us some feedback. It's always helpful. Anything else, Emery, that you want to mention before we sign off today?
Oh, don't have anything. This was an incredible show. I loved talking with Rebecca. That was fascinating.
Me too. And Rebecca, definitely, if you have suggestions for us after the show of other people in your field, we basically mined the Wii Robot speaker roster from this year after it happened. So we have some other folks from there that we're definitely going to try and have on. But if you have other suggestions for us, for folks we should speak to about these issues, we'd love to hear them from you. So let us know.
Will do.
All right. Thanks so much for everyone for joining us on This Week in Law. We'll see you back on July 8th. Take care.